is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. KFJC Los Altos Hills. This is KFJC, and you're tuned in to the special On the Fast Track, featuring the music of Larry Fast and his project name Synergy. And we just heard a track called To the Edge and Back from his CD release, Semiconductor Release 2. And before that, Earth in Space. Also heard in there, we heard from his release, Audion, which came out in the early 80s. We heard the track Shibboleth, and also the tracks Delta 2 and Delta 4 from his album Games, and started off with Phobos and Deimos Go to Mars from his album Chords. Larry Fast is a real hard worker. He worked all through the night, and especially writing the soundtrack for the documentary, which was released in 1984, called The Jupiter Menace. It was about the effect of Jupiter's gravity upon the Earth during a rare planetary alignment, actually a fictional interplanetary disaster, in other words, which turned out to be a terrible film, but the music was no less than stellar. He's still quite active these days. In 2002, he did a concert tour with the Tony Levin Band. He also writes logo spots for television station WGN, and has developed an infrared hearing device for the hearing disabled. I'll talk about that later in the interview. He also has an interest in architecture, and this influences his music, and is still active these days in helping in preservation in these old architecture structures. This is reflected in his music, such as the next track we're going to hear up next from his album Metropolitan Suite on KFJC. You're tuned in to KFJC. This is the Mayhem Special on the Fast Track, featuring the music of Larry Fast under his project name of Synergy. The track we just heard was Steam and Steel Towers from his release Metropolitan Suite. So now we're going to go on and hear the interview, and in the background will be his album Computer Experiments on KFJC. Back in the late 70s, I was introduced to your music by my next-door neighbor who showed me one of your albums, and I listened to it and I thought it was just awesome. And that's kind of what got me started in listening to electronic music.
Oh, well, thanks. And thanks to your neighbor.
So you've been around since the 70s. What inspired you to write electronic music to start with?
Well, I already had a background in electronics and, you know, the underlying technologies that sound recordings share with electronic instruments. And that goes back to stuff I'd been experimenting with in the 60s. And there was already a whole school of composers out of Europe and the United States that had been evolving electronic music. And then, of course, it was very difficult to do, and you had to know the circuitry. So I was teaching myself and learning that even before I was in college, and where I did do some additional engineering studies. But what I did like about it, I mean, I was kind of a rock and roll person from the Beatles era, and I played in bands. But one of the things you have to deal with when you're in a band is other people. And I loved the fact that with electronic music, I could be in control. And I really didn't have to answer to anybody. There were no arguments about how something should happen in music composition. Should it sound this way? Should it sound that way? Should the melody take this turn or that turn? They were all my own internal arguments, but I didn't have to go through that kind of band dynamics that that I've done as well. But mm-hmm. Nice to have an outlet where you don't have to do that. And as things like the Moog synthesizers made the technology a lot more stable, and a lot, it brought a kind of a higher quality to the sound than some of the things I could design, I found that I was able to produce things that were much more to my own liking, and technically achieve them, which had been some of the limitations on some of the earlier equipment. And of course, over the last 35 years or so, it's just gotten better and better and better as it's become more computerized and equipment's gotten better. But mostly I like the control. I like the ability to sculpt and mold sound and music compositions, and it's the best medium to do that.
Yeah, I think the whole electronic music scheme of things is just fantastic. You were inspired by architecture, is that true?
Well, I've always been I studied some architecture in college, mm-hmm. and I've been involved in historic preservation of architecture and kind of keeping an eye on some of the most more modern developments in architecture. And over the years, I noticed that there really was quite a parallel between architecture as an art form in a way itself based on technology and music, electronic music. So I was able to draw some of those parallels in particularly Metropolitan Suite, the album, which was kind of based in a little bit of history and a little bit of New York and a little bit of the radical change in architecture that came with the birth of skyscrapers and the modern city, modern metropolis, that grew up at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. So I was able to kind of track those things together. But even today, my volunteer work is in historic preservation. It's this area where I live is kind of in the middle of several major changes in culture and architecture, going back to the Revolutionary War era, right in the middle of the whole crossroads of the Revolution with battles in the Washington headquarters area, and then later in the 19th century, this became the area where the telegraph was invented, and then Thomas Edison was a few miles from here. So I'm kind of involved in all of that. Bell Laboratories, where so many of the modern inventions of the modern world were created, is within sight of my house. So it's something where it just kind of infuses. That's the environment I'm in, and I think it comes out in the work.
It certainly does. And the Metropolitan Suite, it really speaks about architecture. It's interesting that you have explained all that, because when I've heard it, it really reminds me of, you know, architecture, being in a city somewhere.
It's what I was trying to transmit through the compositions, and the fact mm-hmm. that you got it meant I was successful. So thank you.
That idea comes across really well. Yeah, I like that type of thing. One friend of mine years ago also pointed out that he says to me, "You like music with has noises in it." And I said, "Yeah, I guess you're right, because, you know, hissing and clicks and clacks and, you know, things like that."
Well, they can all be part of the musical vocabulary, and I think mm-hmm. it's really up to the composer, producer, to figure out what's the appropriate vocabulary, you know. And it's no different than writing prose, writing a novel. You know, there are an awful lot of words in the dictionary, but it's a matter of picking the ones that work for what you're trying to express.
You worked also with some other artists and collaborated with Peter Gabriel and Wendy Carlos. Do you do touring anymore?
Well, I had been up until the last, just recently, literally within the last year or two. Peter Gabriel was a long period, many, you know, a decade or so, and we're still in touch, although he's kind of moved into some more, I wouldn't call him retired, but he's not that active now. He's focusing more on his human rights campaigns and other things in his life. The core of the Peter Gabriel band, which was Jerry Murata, the drummer, Tony Levin, the bass player, and me, we were the kind of the mainstays of that for Peter's probably most productive decade. And we started recording and touring as the Tony Levin band starting around 1999. And we toured extensively in several albums, and we were nominated for a Grammy in 2003 for Best Rock Instrumental. And we were on the road right through about 2.5 years ago. And then we've all got other projects that we're doing. It's not as though the band broke up. We've just gotten involved in other things, so we very well might be doing something again. But, yeah, that took us as far as Japan on one side and as far as Russia on the other, and across the United States and Canada several times. For a bunch of guys who were getting a little older, it was a lot of touring. And I've done an occasional solo thing with Synergy. The very last thing that I did was it was under 2 years ago. It was a very short little spate of solo dates, one at the Near Fest Progressive Rock Festival in Pennsylvania. And the very last thing I did was a live concert on XM Satellite Radio.
Are you still touring under the name Synergy, or do you still operate under that name?
Yeah, I do. It's a project name, you know, mm-hmm. over the years. When I first started this whole thing back in the 70s, I didn't know if it was going to become a band. I started it with just me because I thought that was really the way I wanted to establish the parameters of what it was going to be. But I thought it might turn into a band. I don't know what it's going to be. And I also thought that I wanted to hide behind this other entity's name. I just didn't think that my name meant anything. So I figured, well, why not have something like a band name?
Uh-huh.
And, of course, and the word was virtually unknown when I started using it. It was, I had found it in a Buckminster Fuller book, kind of buried in an obscure chapter. And I thought, it's perfect for what I'm doing. But out in the larger culture, nobody'd ever heard that word. And in the intervening decades, it's now really become a buzzword and almost cheapened and silly to a point because of the use in the business community. So the focus has shifted a little more, where I still call the projects the Synergy Projects, but I almost always make sure that my name is attached to it. I think that might have started around Metropolitan Suite. I think the earliest albums always just said Synergy on the front cover, and then you have to go to the back or inside to find my name somewhere. And I think by about the late 80s, we're starting to put in small letters, Larry Fast, Synergy. And so now it's the most recent one, which was, still goes back a couple of years, but from the early 2000s. I think that one's under Larry Fast / Synergy. So I think, if I remember, if you look on iTunes, that one's not under S. It's under L or F or something.
Uh-huh.
And the whole rest of them are under S. So it's just a slight transition. But nope, I'm still using the name, and it's actually a trademarked name, although I'm constantly fighting other people who kind of just come up with a new band or a new dance record or something and call it Synergy, and then I get a whole spate of angry emails from my fans saying, you know, what the heck is this?
Yeah, and there's, yeah, those other bands that are using the same name as you are, and then it gets confusing for, like, if I'm shopping for one of your CDs or something, it's kind of confusing.
It is, and that's exactly the reason why there is trademark law, and so that there can only be one of anything using a given name. But to fight that, there's no trademark police. You know, it's not like you can call an 800 number at the trademark office and say, somebody's using my name, go get them. It doesn't work that way. It means you have to go find out who they are, and then you have to contact them, and then you have to go to court and file a suit if they don't stop. And it gets very expensive, and it's very hard to do it. And if I were to track down every last Synergy, you know, every club band in Indiana that's using the name, I wouldn't have time to do anything else.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have enough money left after paying the lawyers. So it's, you know, try and make sure that the most egregious ones get hit hard, and everybody else hopefully will get the word.
You have better things to do, man.
Yeah. Just popped up on Amazon this week, and they immediately got contacted. So I don't know if they've gone away, but they've been given notice that can't be doing that.
Oh, it's interesting. Yeah, we didn't touch yet on your collaboration with Wendy Carlos. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, it's not a straight collaboration in the sense that Wendy and I've occasionally helped her out, like on a film score if she had a cue that she didn't have time to finish. And we both play each other works in progress. We're very good friends. We've been friends for decades. She's been kind of like an older sister to me, a little bit of a mentor. But she's got skills that she's taught me, and I've got some skills in electronic design and things. She's a physicist, so she's got a good background in things technical, but I've got a little more practical electrical engineering. I actually hold some patents that are essentially electrical engineering patents, so I can help her with the equipment side of it. So it's, the collaboration is not that the two of us sit down and make music together. We just kind of share what we're working on as individual composers and strengthen each other on that. It's great. I mean, I'll play her something, and I'll come back in 2 days later, and there'll be something on voicemail with her singing, if you tried the melody like this, I think it might be better. And, you know, sure enough, it usually is. But it's that kind of thing. You know, at this point, we've never done an album that has both of our names on it as co-equal creators. We're both kind of insular. That thing I was talking about at the beginning, about how I like not having to answer to anybody.
Yeah.
And I can control my own destiny. Take my attitude and multiply it, and you've got her attitude. She is a wonderful, self-contained musical genius, and she doesn't need somebody else to bounce ideas off of. Certainly not me. You know, I think that the way that she works best alone. It's like asking for either of us, if we're working in that mode, it's like asking an author, you know, to, you know, why don't you go write your novel with this other guy who was also a great novelist? But it's not going to work that way. You know, they don't, you create these things in your own space. And she's like that 100% of the time. I'm like that when I'm working on Synergy, but when I'm working in a band format or as a producer with some other musicians, I've got another mental attitude I can put on in those cases. But I think having the knowledge that the self-contained solo thing is there, I think makes me work better with other people, because if I lose an argument about how something should go, I don't go away mad. I just say, well, that's okay. We'll do it your way. But I've got my other project where you don't have any say in it, so I'm not worried about it. I've always got an outlet.
I heard your little shorts you wrote for WGN on your... Actually, I read part of your blog.
I'm very bad at keeping that up, and I've got to get back to do some more. but thanks. Yeah, I had done something very similar for XM Satellite Radio, which was used for almost the first 8 or 9 years they were on the air.
Yeah, I've been watching WGN, like, in just this last year or so. And then I saw your blog with your... The shorts. I think. What do you call those things? Shorts.
Well, little logos.
Logos. That was
it. Funny. TV, they're logos, and radio, they're sounders, but they're really the same thing. They're the little, you know, couple of second little pings to identify things. Although I've done longer things for WGN. There are what are really small songs that they use in their promotions and under the sports and other things like that.
Yeah, I heard them, and I thought, oh, I've been listening to all this time, you know, watching WGN.
It's, a lot of us have done that. Wendy, in earlier on in her career, right after Switched on Bach, was a huge success, did a number of things for commercials. It's another side of being a musician and a composer, is that particularly these days in the record industry, it's such a changing landscape, and I've been very fortunate that I've been involved in some very successful records over the years, but the synergy things tend to be a little more cult-like, so in order to make sure that there's a well-rounded stream of income to give me the freedom to do the things that I want to do, I work in some of these more, I guess you could call it the commercial market. It's being a composer for hire. And I've done things for Disney, and I've done things for other major corporate entities. Johnson & Johnson, I did a lot of work for them that was almost all in-house. And it's kind of neat. I mean, I get to do a lot of composing. There's probably twice as much stuff out there within the corporate environment and these other things like working for Disney than the Synergy albums on their own. You know, probably at least the equivalent of maybe another 8 or 10 albums worth of material out there. But it's not identified as such. And, of course, the way the business is in those, like when you do something for Disney, they pay very nicely, but then they own it. And if they choose not to put it out on a recording, it's not going to be heard anywhere outside of where they decide they want it heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that, you know, that's fine. I go into these things knowing that's exactly what it is. You're a hired composer. And it's in some ways, it's like film scoring, especially in the heyday of the studios. You know, you had some fabulous composers, and they were paid a weekly paycheck. And they got their health coverage and their social security and everything, and they could go home to a nice, stable family life. And yet, at the same time, they were writing great music, but it wasn't really theirs anymore. It would always be theirs because they composed it, but what happened to it, depending on what MGM or Universal or Warner Brothers decided was going to happen to it. And this is the modern equivalent of that.
You've written a couple of film scores, like Jupiter Menace, and which, well, that was a documentary, wasn't it?
It was a weird documentary.
Because I've never seen it.
It wasn't a great film. It was good for me because the film company, the producer, and the people that were putting the film together liked my music, and they wanted to license some of it from the record company, and then they wanted to, they needed some new things to be written, and I had never worked on a Hollywood feature before. So it was a wonderful educational experience for me because just some of the technical details of what's needed to do with film composition were all new to me, and it was good. It was a small company. It was a film that I pretty much knew right from seeing the first rushes of it wasn't going to be a hit. I knew it was going to die. So it was good. I got to make all my mistakes kind of out of the limelight. And the scoring came out okay. In fact, the production values on the film weren't bad for the time, although it's a long time ago now. But it was a sort of a science fiction documentary based on a very flawed premise about the end of the Earth, and it I got to admit, it just got silly at places. So I'm sort of glad that the film it died, and I don't think it's available anywhere. and the music, which was pretty good. Mm. Some of the computer graphics people were very good too. They later went on to do some of the much more spectacular Hollywood blockbusters. I think some of them were involved with the later Terminator movies and some of the Cameron stuff. And it was all very early in this, so we were all just kind of fooling around with the equipment, trying to figure out what it could all do. But then I've done some later things, but they were small films for HBO and a few other things. And it's tough. The East Coast, being based in the New York area and touring and having connections more to the United Kingdom, when I was getting a little bit of traction in films and I came out and spoke with some of the agents, the Hollywood-based agents, and came with my lawyer, we had some very productive conversations, but they said, you're really going to have to give up everything else and come out here, move out here, make yourself available. You know, we'll see if we can land you scoring on a sitcom on network or something. We'll work you up to feature films over maybe a 10-year period. And really, honestly, wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't want to give up making records so that I could score some sitcom and eventually get a feature film. I would rather just do what I was continuing to do.
A sitcom?
Well, that's kind of the hierarchy. You know, they don't look at it and say, oh, you're an interesting avant-garde electronic composer. They say you're just a working guy. You're a composer. You have the skills. And this is where we start you. You know, we'll get you some sitcom on Fox or the CW or something. And then prove your mettle on that, and we'll move you up. And maybe someday you'll get to a nice network show. And then from the network show, we'll get you into a small movie. And then maybe someday you'll be doing a big blockbuster movie. But it's, there is a hierarchy. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to play that game. I wanted to play the record game instead.
Yeah, like you were saying earlier, you don't want to answer to somebody that, you know, you don't want to play by their plan for your music career.
No, I mean, this is nice because I can, with the commercial, you know, like doing things for WGN or Turner Broadcasting, I can make that a part of what I do. But it doesn't dominate and it doesn't completely remove everything else.
What kind of tools are you using today?
Well, it's gotten progressively more computerized over the years. I rarely use any of the analog equipment anymore. So currently, I've got a Kurzweil 2661 as sort of the main keyboard. And a couple of little modules, an old Roland module, some EMU, Turbo XL1, a couple of things like that. But I've moved off a lot of the sound generating now is in the computer. So I've got currently a Macintosh Mac Pro quad core with Mark of the Unicorn has been my main sequencer. And some of the software things like Omnisphere and let's see what else, Mach 5 from Mark of the Unicorn is the sort of sampling tool. Those are the primary things, but you know, it gives me enough flexibility that I can create just about anything that I want, either in a digital simulation of old synthesis techniques and on screen, and then allows me to have almost everything at my fingertips. And it's very flexible. It's a wonderful surround sound capable digital recording environment as well as a composing environment.
And in the old days, you used Apple?
Well, yeah, I've actually been an Apple owner since they first started. I got an Apple II in 1977 and made up custom cards for it, and I do a fair amount of computer programming, particularly back then. So I was experimenting with using the computers to control the analog synthesizers back in the 70s. I was also part of a project at Bell Labs around those same years, about 75 through 80, which was my first complete immersion in digital recording and digital synthesis. But it was all on big mainframe computers in a laboratory environment. And I loved it. I mean, I was already chafing at the limitations of the analog Moog synthesizers. So to have this digital thunder available was fabulous. But I really didn't, back then, I couldn't imagine that in my lifetime it would be cheap enough to ever have anything like that for a private individual, only for a multi-billion-dollar corporation to allow you some work time on it. And, of course, now what I have on my laptop MacBook Pro dwarfs what was in that mainframe computer at Bell Laboratories, you know, for the phone company's development division back then. So it moved very, very quickly.
And things changed so much in just even 5-10 years.
Oh, absolutely. I've got analog tape machines here. I've got DAT recorders. I've got all kinds of things in the studio that just don't get switched on anymore. It's really just a computer and about maybe 3 or 4 of the more recent versions of digital hardware synthesizers. And that's it.
Yeah, around here at the station, we got a few old equipment dinosaurs of old tape machines they don't use anymore.
Yeah, I mean, just getting tape is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very expensive compared to what it once was. It used to be a cheap recording medium, and now you can, you know, it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars a reel for 22 minutes of recording time.
I read somewhere that you helped design the Polymoog.
Yeah, that was one of those things where the biographer for my record company was a little overstretching. Basically, I came in near the end of the development phase of it as a musician to evaluate it and make some suggestions. And I did have a lot of suggestions, most of which were ignored. And I helped them launch it. And then the Memory Moog, which followed on, I did have a lot more input on that. In fact, I designed about half of the sounds that shipped with it. And they did take into account some of the things that I was doing. But for some reason, the Polymoog is the one that keeps getting perpetuated.
You know, something I was wondering about a little while ago is the cover on your album, Chords. Because I've always liked that picture. Is there any special meaning behind that? Or?
No, it was, I'm on the cover in the background. I'm the guy with the kind of sheepskin coat, very small.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a model who was standing there on this freezing night in New York winter, just before a storm came in. And Hypnosis, which is the design firm out of England that did Pink Floyd covers and Yes covers and Genesis covers, many of the Peter Gabriel covers too. They're really just an art design house, and they conceptualized whatever they wanted and kind of took it or left it. If you didn't like what they had, then too bad, we didn't have much say in it, which was fine. But they also had a wonderful reputation. They were very creative. But they came up with that entire concept, everything from the location. They arranged the models. I went there because I wanted to watch the photo shoot go on, and they kind of drafted me into being in the picture. But that was just a little afterthought on the photographer's part on the night. But they explained to me what they were going to do, and I saw a sketch before it was shot. I thought it looked pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it didn't mean anything in particular.
Oh, okay.
There's not a direct connection as far as me spurring something or it having a particular meaning. I mean, something like Metropolitan Suite, which has the electronic skyline, that, of course, is a direct... That was something that I actually came up with the concept and executed a lot of it electronically. So, you know, that one's got much more of a direct connection. But largely, particularly the earlier Synergy albums, the record company was the one that was paying for the photo sessions. They were paying for the production of the record, all things surrounding the record. I was providing a lot of the studio services to actually make the recording, but when it came to what the cover was going to be and who was going to press it up and getting it out, that was all in their control, and they just did what they thought, what marketing told them would work. I had a little bit of say in it, you know, and they wouldn't have done anything if I hated it, I'm sure, but that was really up to the art director at the record company and the record company president and the people who made those decisions.
Now, when those couple of tracks on there, the Phobos and Demos Go to Mars.
We were doing that live with the Tony Levin band for years. In fact, we have a live album called Double Espresso, which features the whole band doing that mm-hmm. back, you know, 2000 something. It's very powerful with like a full band doing it. Yeah, it was live on tour. We recorded a 2-CD set. I think it was also, we did a studio version of it on the album called Pieces of the Sun, also the Tony Levin Band.
Is that still available?
I'm pretty sure it is.
Wow.
I haven't looked for a while to see, but you know, I'm still getting some royalties on it.
About the infrared hearing device?
Oh, sure.
Are you still working on that? Is that out now? Or
yeah, oh yeah, it's been out for 16 years they've been shipping now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something that came up. This was kind of the an arc in the electronics side of my life. Back in the 70s, well, the 60s for me, when I was in high school, I was always building things, soldering things, designing things, learning how to make transistors and later integrated circuits, do what I wanted to do. And most of that got focused in my work in both audio for recording studios and how to make better sound in the recording world. And then later, synthesizers was perfect for that because I could be designing custom modules. I could do whatever I wanted. And then sitting down with, you know, first designing something, doing the calculations, and then sitting down with soldering iron and hand tools and making things. And then they worked. And I built big pieces of equipment that toured with me with Peter Gabriel, and you know, there was a lot of things that only I had because they were my own, and I'd done a couple of custom things for Rick Wakeman and a few other people from time to time, but mostly I never made a business out of it. It was just, this was part of how I made the tools so I could make the art. And as things became more computerized and as the 80s wore on, synthesizers became these pretty much impenetrable commodity pieces made by Yamaha or other companies over in Japan. If you opened them up, it was nothing but three or four integrated circuits on a big board, and there was nothing you could really do to modify them anymore. So I was kind of feeling a little left out, as though I wasn't getting my hands dirty in the electronics side anymore. And my wife was working as a tech doing assistive listening systems for the hearing disabled in theaters and on Broadway, and you know, she was a great person, also doing soldering and all this kind of stuff. We're very, very compatible that way. And she was started to work in with the court systems, and it turned out they needed a much smaller system than theaters needed, and nobody was manufacturing one. We couldn't find a single one that was worth a darn on the market. And so I went back and I did the calculations and I got out the soldering iron and I built up a prototype, and it was a hit. And she had started a company, so I'm basically an employee of her company. And
way to go.
So it's great. It's what she does, but I designed the product.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been in production. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them out in courtrooms, predominantly in the Northeast, but there are some all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up with patents on that. That's what I was talking about before. And in a funny kind of way, it's all related to the same technologies as synthesizers and recording studio equipment, recording consoles, mic preamps, sound processing equipment. In fact, what I did that was unique was I brought that world of high-end recording and synthesis into what's kind of an offshoot of audiology, which apparently wasn't doing that before, and that's what was patentable. So, no, it does very well. She's got a state contract with New York right now that she's filling. And so my little things, and the irony is I designed all the circuit boards, and they have the little synergy symbol on all of them inside. That's my own little thing. So they're initialed, and they have that on it, so anybody who knows. I go to trade shows occasionally with her for the professional audio or the courts or something, and there's always some synergy fan who kind of looks at me, looks at the thing. The thing actually looks like a little bit like a Mini Moog. In terms of design, it's got wood, black panel, silver controls, that kind of thing. So even though it's not an instrument, it shares some of that same pedigree. And there are people who come up and they go, what are you doing here? Or what are you doing here? So it confuses them a little bit, but it's good. I think it keeps me in touch with the electronics part of who I am.
You know, we're located out here is in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And right in the middle of all this, you know, companies that started up here, semiconductor, Apple computer, and...
That's right. Well, I had been at Apple when they were... I'd been at the Cupertino campus a number of times, but when they were in a little building back around 1978 near Keyboard Magazine. They were, like, in the same little office park campus.
I remember that. I've been to there, that place before, yeah.
I think it was also in Cupertino, but...
Yeah, it was in Cupertino.
But, yeah, a lot of sequential circuits, which is in San Jose, they're the people that invented MIDI, basically. It's, a wonderful area.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some of Max Matthews, who was the head of the electronic music at Murray Hill Bell Laboratories, when he retired from the phone company, ended up at Stanford. So he's part of the academic music community there now.
Really glad you've kept up with your the whole package, I guess you could say. Don't know what the word is. The whole synergy package is. So what are you excited about right now about, and what do you have planned for the near future?
Well, I've been very, very slowly, but continuing to try to put together the next Synergy album or albums. I've got about 8 or 9 different things started but incomplete, and it's trying to find the time to get to a conclusion on some of those. I've been working with another friend of mine who I've known for many years, a very talented guitarist, and I'm helping him write his solo album. He's got a pending deal with one of the big distributors, so I'm working on that, moving that forward. I've been in touch with Tribune Broadcasting. They would like to have me do more for them, and that's right now that's hung up. It's not even hung up, it's just in negotiations. I stay out of that. That's their business people and my business people talking, and when everything's done from them, then we'll go back to talking about the creative side of it. And a couple of variations on the stuff for the hearing disabled, too, because I do keep a hand in that.
Mm-hmm.
Not my 24/7 job or anything like that, but it's something that I do stay on top of. So there's, you know, at least maybe 12 weeks out of every year gets devoted almost entirely to that. And what else? Oh, and historic preservation. Chair grants committee for this region, where we distribute literally several $1 million every year for the preservation of historic buildings. And we are going to start reviewing those in May. It's going to be my 7th year doing that.
Are you going to be writing any new albums? Is it going to be new material?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. When I have, more than a half a dozen, 6 or 8 pieces that are in various stages of going together, that's exactly what that is.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And they're just unfinished. They're set aside to become Synergy projects at some point. And I've been slowly edging towards finding time to make that happen. And it's, with so much going on in my life, it's tough to find the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I really need to make more time. And we'll see. If all I can do is try. But absolutely, I'd very much like to do that. In fact, when the same label that is talking to the guitarist that I'm working with right now has been almost hounding me to get us something, we would like to put it out. So I'm more than happy to accommodate them.
Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills, Cell 9000 here with you. The last few minutes of the Mayhem Special on the Fast Track. What we just heard was an interview with Larry Fast and talking about all the things he's been doing these last few years and recently as well. Going to end the show with one final track from his latest release,